there is still going to be a lot of polarizing factors in Thai politics.
Vote counting continues in Thailand. It's Tuesday, March 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, vigils continue in New Zealand. Tensions are down but simmering between India and Pakistan. A Chinese-built dam begins to power Uganda. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Thais waited Monday for the results of an election called a return to democratic rule, but which has been widely criticized as an exercise designed by Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha to entrench his military stranglehold on power. Preliminary official results released late Sunday showed that with 93% of the ballots counted, the military-backed Falang Parachat Party was in the lead with about 7.6 million votes. That's short of what would be needed for a majority in parliament. In second place was the Pheu Thai Party, a former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, with 7.1 million votes. The campaign was marred by allegations of vote buying. However, complaints were few on polling day, with election observers from Australia, Canada, the United States, and the 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on hand. Security was tight, and opinions were mixed as about 52 million Thais voted. But the long shadow of the military is still having an impact, and most of those willing to express an opinion declined to be identified. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about the Thai vote with Ian Beard, director of the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at the University of Wisconsin.
There are people that are making various allegations about whether there has been some interference in the vote, you know, double voting or things like this. The turnout seems to be a lot lower than people expected, which also has raised some questions. These are just allegations at this point, and it's hard to know how much truth is in them. It's still going to take a long time for them to figure out the party vote proportion of the seats. That won't be announced until early May. So there's a lot of speculation right now and uncertainty. It would appear that, on the one hand, the military party has a great advantage because they start off with 250 seats, presumably coming from the unelected members. However, they may require to have a coalition partner, and at this point it's not clear who that might be or if any of the other parties are willing to enter into a coalition with the pro-military party.
What are the problems associated with the military party not winning?
I think either way, there is still going to be a lot of polarizing factors in Thai politics, right? Because the constitution of Thailand is set up in such a way now that it's not really a fully democratic system, because you have one-third of the seats are now given to the military to appoint. So, you know, this is a very uncertain situation right now, because it seems that the same sort of divisions that have been plaguing Thailand for many years are continuing. There's still a lot to be determined here.
How strong is the military still in Thailand? This is basically for our listeners and readers who are not following this on an everyday basis.
Well, the military in Thailand is very powerful. And, of course, Thailand has the history of a very large number of coups and attempted coups over many decades. And so the military has not simply, kept to the barracks and dealt with military affairs. They've often inserted themselves into politics. It is what is happening right now, because they are attempting to convert, a government that was based on a military coup into a civilian military government with a new constitution that the military essentially wrote, and which gives the military a major major role in politics to try to basically prevent the parties that were in some ways linked to Thaksin Shinawat, who was removed in a coup in 2006, and then later his sister, when she became prime minister afterwards, was also removed in a coup. And so they're trying to prevent their supporters from returning to power.
What do you think is going to happen, and what do you think the state of affairs is overall?
Well, I think the state of affairs is uncertain. I don't expect that there'll be, in the immediate future, there'll be a lot of violence happening in Thailand. I don't think that will be a concern. But I do think that the way the constitution in Thailand is written now is not satisfactory to a lot of people there. And so I think we can expect to see more, that the political situation is not going to be smooth going ahead, I don't think.
Ian Beard, director of the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at the University of Wisconsin, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Military-backed party leads in Thai elections. New Zealand launching fact-finding inquiry into mosque attacks. U.S. Navy and Coast Guard ships pass through strategic Taiwan Strait. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories with videos and photos and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thousands of people attended a vigil in Christchurch, New Zealand to protest racism and to remember the 50 Muslims who were killed in two mosques last week by a white nationalist. Many of the women in attendance continued making and wearing headscarves in solidarity with their Muslim neighbors. Arash Arabasadi reports.
Volunteers come together Sunday, sewing headscarves at a community center in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Well, personally, I love sewing, and this is a way that I can contribute, doing something that I enjoy. And no, I have no problem at all with... I was wearing a headscarf myself earlier on, and no, I'm fine with anybody that to show their face.
Libby Davis lives in Christchurch. There, a gunman opened fire during Friday prayers at two mosques on March 15th, killing 50 people. A week later, the greater community mourned the victims. Since then, women in Christchurch donned headscarves in support of the Muslim community.
We just want to let them know that we're there for them, and we've heard that some Muslims haven't felt safe going out in their headscarves, and we want to show them that it's still a safe community even though the terror attack has happened.
The vigil comes just 2 days after the first Friday prayer since the massacre.
I loved it. Like, on Friday, I went to the Friday prayer, and I couldn't tell who was Muslim, who wasn't, and it was really heartwarming. And then my professor also wore the hijab, and a few classmates of mine wore the hijab, too, and it's, like, really awesome to see. I definitely support it.
Thousands attended Sunday's vigil in Christchurch. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has called the shooting a terror attack and announced changes to the country's gun laws with support from the head of New Zealand's Police Association. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Nearly a month ago, tensions quickly rose between India and Pakistan, and that raised fears the two nuclear-armed neighbors were moving toward war. One region, Kashmir, a disputed territory both countries want, suffered the brunt of the crisis. Cross-border shelling forced people to flee, disrupting lives and livelihoods. Hostilities have eased since then with the help of intense international diplomacy, but the situation is still not back to normal, and many who return to Kashmir fear tensions will rise again. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Chakoti, Kashmir.
This mother is doing everything to give her kids a normal routine here in Kashmir's border town of Chakoti. But the children are still suffering the effects of all the fighting around them.
I cooked last night, but these kids did not eat. They were just too afraid. Firing scared them.
Classes have resumed in this town battered by fighting between India and Pakistan, but attendance is low. Some families who fled in February when fighting escalated between the two nuclear-armed countries are trickling back. Chakoti, on the Pakistani side, faced some of the worst shelling. At the peak of the hostilities, almost the entire population was forced to flee, many in the middle of the night and on foot due to the heavy firing.
Only a few people have returned here or there. Some shops are open now, but it's not the same hustle and bustle we used to have in the bazaar.
Indian and Pakistani armies regularly fire at each other in Kashmir across what is known as the line of control. Though tensions have eased, life remains uneasy. Some have built bunkers, but many are left exposed. Residents say as they try to return to normal, they live in fear tensions will rise again and uncertainty about their fate if they do. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Chakoti.
Coming up, China brings water power to Uganda. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia. South Korea said some North Korean officials returned to an inter-Korean liaison office Monday, 3 days after the North abruptly withdrew its entire staff, citing unspecified instructions from, quote, higher-level authorities. Visit VOA 60 for more and VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Uganda has launched a Chinese-built hydropower dam in the eastern part of the country, which will improve access to power, but at the cost of the local environment. The $568 million Isimba hydropower dam will cut electricity costs and put more Ugandans on the power grid, in a country where less than 30% of the population has access to power. But as Halima Atumani reports from Kayunga, the dam comes at a price for the local people and ecology.
The Victoria Nile River is for many locals the only water source for cleaning, bathing and drinking. But a fence for the just-completed Isimba hydropower dam is cutting off their access. The dam, constructed by China International Water and Electric Corporation, will increase electricity access to the less than 30% of Ugandans who have it and cut power costs. But it has come at a price for the local ecology as well. Before the dam, this Uganda part of the Nile River brought tourists to its waterfalls and wildlife. At the launch Thursday, officials acknowledged choosing 183 megawatts of clean power over access to water and natural beauty.
It's been a delicate balance for government, but we have to make that choice. And therefore, with the coming in place of this hydropower station, it meant that, of course, would disrupt the social setting up of the communities around.
Critics say China's infrastructure projects in Africa increase Beijing's influence on the continent, along with African debt. China's ambassador to Uganda, Zeng Zhuqiang, calls the allegations groundless.
On the contrary, in pursuing cooperation, China values sincerity, friendship, and equality, pursue common interests, win-win cooperation, and put friendship first.
In addition to the Isimba Dam, China is also financing the $2 billion US, 600 megawatt Karuma hydropower dam in northern Uganda. Once active, the two hydropower dams will nearly double Uganda's power supply. Uganda's future generations will see if the electricity is worth the cost. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kayunga.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the radio throughout Asia on great radio stations like PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University. That's in Thailand. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today. And as always, we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team is Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. And if you liked our Facebook feed, we thank our intern Yellen for bringing that to us today. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.